Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the show. As you know, many people who were involved in cults like the IFB or in the troubled teen industry have missed out on some truly memorable moments, things like prom and graduation ceremonies. And it's heartbreaking to hear that they have missed out on things that so many have taken for granted. Today's guest is working on something truly amazing called Survivor Prom. This event is for survivors of the troubled teen industry, cults, and other congregate care settings. It's a chance for adults who missed out on prom and other milestones to come together and celebrate each other. But it's about so much more than just prom. It's a symbol of taking back the years of their lives that they lost while in these programs. And it's not just about the big moments like prom or graduation ceremonies. Survivors have missed out on forming friendships, learning how to be part of a team, and even just figuring out who they really are. It's no secret these programs can have a devastating effect on social skills, and some people have even gone through extreme things like conversion therapy that have made adjusting to everyday life really difficult. So for many survivors, prom is about taking back the time that was stolen from them. It's a chance to celebrate each other and rebuild after some truly challenging times. Now, some might say that having an event like prom is a little bit petty, but for survivors of the troubled teen industry, it is so much more than that. It is a symbol of coming together and celebrating resilience and strength. And I cannot wait to see how this event turns out. Please listen to this entire episode. We're going to hear all about this incredible event. And if you want to support the event financially, head to the link in the show notes and find out how you can do just that. All right, without further ado, let's get into today's show.
Remember high school? You had your group of friends, maybe even your high school sweetheart.
You made the team.
You picked a random elective.
And you found yourself a lifelong passion. You learned so much more than just algebra. There's a reason they call these the most formative years of our lives. Now, imagine who you'd be if none of that ever happened. What if you didn't have a single friend to lean on during those years? What if you never experienced the camaraderie or value of teamwork? Or saw the impact you had when you cheered for others?
What if no teacher ever encouraged you to pursue your passions, and your education was unaccredited, lacking, or non-existent? This was the reality for survivors of the troubled teen industry, and we are taking our teenage dreams back with Survivor Prom. It's not your average prom. Survivor Prom is meant for adults who endured so much that they may have the chance to reclaim just one small piece of the high school experience they never had. Support the Survivor community today by clicking the link below and donating. Follow and share our journey at Survivor Prom.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast. Welcome back, Hannah.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric.
I'm starting to sound repetitive, but like every episode where I have someone on again, I'm like, oh, I thought you were on like a year ago. And then it's like, oh, it was 3 years ago. We talked in 2020 and you shared your story. And if anybody hasn't heard your full story, they should go back and listen to that episode for sure. But for those that are not going to do that because they're stubborn like me when I listen to podcasts, give us just a little bit of a recap of your story. You obviously were heavily involved in the troubled teen industry. You spent 13 to 18 within one of these homes. Just give us a little bit of background as to how you ended up involved in the troubled teen industry.
So as you mentioned, I kind of entered the program that I attended, which was called Lighthouse Christian Academy. I entered there when I was about a week before my 13th birthday. And the reason that my parents chose to have me taken to this place was because, you know, I was what they call a troubled teen or an out of control teen. And I think it's so important to always highlight when I say this, that many, many people who end up in the troubled teen industry are not troubled teens. They are normal teenagers who like had a bad grade, spilt the milk at the dinner table. Parents were sick of dealing with them and kind of pawned them off. Like there are bad parents who just drop their kids off. There are foster care kids who get strapped into these situations and just left there until they age out. So I always like to hang a bell on that. But for me, I was getting into trouble. I was skipping school, running away, that sort of thing. And my parents did not have the resources or the information or the education to find an appropriate treatment for me. So they were looking for options and they came across this facility. And this facility, you know, the entire experience began by me actually being what we call legally kidnapped, which means that some strangers came into my bedroom in the middle of the night when I was 13 years old and dragged me out of my bed. And, you know, we always say they give you the easy way or the hard way. It's quite literally what they say to us as children. And what that implies is that if you do not go willingly with them, they are going to physically, you know, remove you from the home. They'll restrain you with handcuffs. I've seen boots put on children as a means to keep them from running away, et cetera. But I was about 80 pounds soaking wet at the time. So I complied immediately. And they took me out, put me in a car that looked like a police car on the inside, but a red Camaro on the out. And they took me to Jay, Florida, put me on a couple planes and took me to Jay, Florida, where this program was. This program was a religious program. There's lots of different types of programs within the TTI or the troubled teen industry umbrella. Things like rehabs, boot camps, wilderness camps, behavior modification centers, all kinds of programs, but religious programs are one small part of that. And this was an independent fundamental Baptist program that was inspired by the Lester Roloff schools, I'm sure you're familiar with. In fact, the man who actually owned this program to begin with, his name was Michael Palmer, was close with him. And so it was a very easy jump. And if you talk to really any of the Baptist program survivors, we pretty much all have the same story. The programs are run very, very similarly, even the attire, you know, the school, the ACE curriculum, that whole bit. Is pretty similar, but the experience within the program itself is like death by a thousand cuts. You take places like Hiles Anderson, which I also attended, and you think those rules are crazy and strict and weird. Multiply that by 1,000, and then you might be close to my program. I mean, this was a place where you were not allowed to so much as crack your own knuckles or pick your fingernails without getting sent to an isolation box and being put in like isolation from your peers for 3 days. Like that actually happened. This place was incredibly abusive physically. in that they would have us restrain each other. Like I would be forced to tackle my peers, hold them to their beds limb by limb. I also had that done to me. I've also seen children dragged across the field because they were not running enough. You know, I've seen children scolded and really pushed into this narrative because it was a girls' program that women are, you know, to be good wives. They actually, you know, did the whole putting us through wife classes and teaching us how to be, you know, nice, submissive baby makers, you know, and so it was incredibly spiritually abusive as well. And I always like to hang a bell on that because that's specific to religious programs. Oftentimes, you know, we went to church 21 times a week. And this was not the once a day chapel before school started. Like this was indoctrination and forced participation in religion that many children came in and were not subscribed to. Many of them came from Catholic households. Many of them came from different denominations of Christianity that were not this extreme. And they were forced to participate in these activities. I mean, forcing a child to pray, like how is that in line at all with any version of Christianity, forcing religion onto a child, forcing them to participate, not just close your eyes when I'm praying, like we do to children sometimes. Like this is forcing them to out loud pray to a God that they don't subscribe to. And so that's why this is a religious program. I also consider it a cult because I don't know any other, even sect of, you know, the IFB. I couldn't name an IFB church that is this bad, that is this extreme in forcing their beliefs on others. Now, I know them to be that crazy, but I don't know them to be that extremist in terms of the indoctrination and forced participation.
Yeah. Well, like you said, there's levels to it, right? So like, it's always interesting. And I think we all, you know, we've all experienced our own thing. So like, there's like these weird rankings of like, what's worse, quote unquote, you know, and, you know, and so someone coming from like there to a Hiles Anderson might go, Hiles Anderson's a breath of fresh air, you know, or someone going from one church in this part of the country might go to a church in another part of the country and say, oh, this isn't too bad. You know, your experience, you know, and I was re-listening to our episode together, and it was one of the episodes where I was like, oh, this is a really good episode. but it was great because you mentioned the easy way or the hard way, and it implies that there's this choice of like, there's this easy way. There's this way that you can do it where there's no resistance. It's going to be totally fine. And you said something kind of profound, which is there's no easy way to be kidnapped from your home in the middle of the night and taken to one of these facilities. And I think you've done a really good job since before our episode, but in the time that's passed since people have last heard from you, you've done a really good job just raising that awareness about how bad this industry really is. Talk to me a little bit about that. I definitely want to get into Hiles Anderson, but I want to talk about just kind of the advocacy side of this and what it's been like sharing your story openly. Do you have any regrets even starting opening that can of worms? Are you happy with progress that's been made? Because there's been homes that have been shut down. Like, what have you seen the last 2 years that makes you either optimistic or kind of pessimistic?
Yeah, I love this. I love this kind of talk. So I started my advocacy journey, I'm going to guess like 3 years ago now. Don't quote me on it. But I started just a couple months before the documentary This Is Paris came out, where Paris Hilton came out and talked about her experience with the troubled teen industry. And so I was just a little bit prior to that. So I really got in on like the golden age of troubled teen industry advocacy. And it's been an incredible adventure and such a learning experience. This community of survivors is incredibly unique, like love-hate relationship, to be perfectly honest with you. It's been ups and it's been downs, because this is a community that has been absolutely abused. Like you say, there are people who go, oh, you know, this is worse, this is better. You know, even I sometimes find myself getting caught in this judgmental circle of like, where I'm like, well, I was at my program for 4 years. I'm like, it wrecked my entire identity and like my sense of self. And I didn't know who I was when I came out. So when people would tell me, oh, I went to my program for 6 months, I'm like, okay, can't easy. Relate. You know, like I would try to be like, I get it. But at the end of the day, I had to learn that it doesn't matter how long the abuse is, what occurred, like what level of serious, like, did you get sexually assaulted? Did you, you know, all these things. It's the fact that people have their own limits to abuse and how that affects them. And so it doesn't matter what the timeline is, what type of program, if you were even in residential or you went to Hiles Anderson, you can suffer from the same consequences of these cults or these programs. And so anyway, but back to advocacy, the community has been so amazing in helping me learn about other types of programs. For one, wilderness camps was not something I was very familiar with, even though all these types of programs kind of have the same goal in that they want children to change their behavior. Their methods can differ greatly. Like at my program, I was not able to like have friends. And I talked to other survivors and they're like, you weren't allowed to have friends. Like their programs are a little bit different, but at the same time, they didn't get like proper food. You know, they didn't like, they were like cooking beans on like a fire outside or something if they were lucky and ate like stale rice or I don't know, but they had this terrible, but I had like, okay, well, I had no friends. And so there's just all these incredibly abusive varying elements of these programs that I've learned about through like my advocacy journey. And I don't regret it. Not for one second. I definitely have times where I feel re-traumatized by sharing my story all the time or really going in deep with people. Mm-hmm. And in those moments I take breaks. I mean, I did TikTok, you know, I had that Highway 89 survival TikTok where I had like 65,000 followers. And around that time I was like, I can't sustain this, you know. On TikTok you gotta post all the time, and it was just not something that like my heart and soul was allowing me to do on a regular basis and like be okay. Like it was super draining. But now I'm so thrilled because there's so many amazing TikTokers speaking about the TTI, people from wilderness camps, people from religious programs, people from WASP programs. There's so many of them, you know. I don't feel any burden to be like, oh, I need to be out there telling people about this. Like,
right.
People are learning. Like, people are knowing. Like, if it's not Paris Hilton's huge platform that's doing a lot for us, it's all these amazing survivors that are just getting out there and speaking their truth. And I don't feel like I need to be there. It's happening. You know, it's not as urgent, I think, as it once was for people to know about this.
Right. Yeah. And you can be selective with involvement too. Like that's the thing you mentioned, like posting on TikTok every day. Like you're not just a piece of content, you know? So it's there's going to be days you don't want to talk about it. And that might be bad for the algorithm, but it's really good for you. And if you have to weigh those things out, probably should pick the one that's good for you.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, one of the things you mentioned, Paris Hilton's documentary, which it was so weird because I had just started really even hearing about it. So my first time, like where I heard that it was a problem was, you know, the Dr. Phil episode, which that's a whole nother can of worms. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Phil's very involved with all that stuff. We don't have to go down that rabbit hole. But when he talked about Hepzibah House, I was like, oh, I recognize Agape. I always thought that was a good place. It started unwinding kind of the fantasy version of all of this. Then I think we connected. That's when I connected with so many different people in the advocacy space. And then it was like Paris Hilton drops this documentary and everyone's tagging me on it going, hey, this is about the stuff you've been talking, you know? So it's like very weird how that happened. Yeah. But Paris Hilton's like advocacy shone a huge light on this issue, but also upset a lot of people. And I've like tried to wrap my head around like why so many people are like upset about her pushing for awareness about, you know, this industry. Like, it seems like it's been a point of contention within survivor community from the outside looking in. Have you seen that as well? Or
I've seen some of that. And frankly, you know, when Paris was first coming on the scene, I mean, even when we met, when we were at the Provo Canyon protest, I spoke to her and I spoke to her, her man there, and I let them know, I'm like, listen, the community is really like unsure of you guys, honestly. Like I literally told her husband this. I said, you know, she's kind of shown up like in a whirlwind here, and people are thinking, is this a PR stunt? Like, are you just using this to work on changing your image? And are you going to use this community? Are you going to like suck it dry of everybody's stories? People were feeling like, you know, is my story now owned by Paris Hilton if I share it with her platform? And like, you know, people were just uneasy, you know, and it makes sense. We're a community that's incredibly traumatized. We have trust issues.
And I've been taken advantage of. Yeah.
We've been taken advantage of. So I don't think it's unreasonable to have these concerns at all. I think Paris over the last couple of years, though, because that was back in 2020, I think that she has really proven herself in terms of like her commitment to the cause. I mean, she has been working on legislation. And I think there are questions within the survivor community about the adequacy of the legislation that she has been promoting. There's like a big argument on whether or not, you know, passing laws that kind of create loopholes or essentially say your program can operate if it does X, Y, Z is legitimizing the industry. So that's one of the things that people kind of get hung up on. You know, if you kind of think, is it creating loopholes for programs to operate, or is it abolishing the industry? And a lot of the legislation that she, I think, is working on is creating standards. But you also have to ask yourself, is that just the beginning stages? You know,
it's like, an incremental approach.
Yeah, I think the goal is to find something that's suitable for both sides of the aisle and kind of build from there. That's what I think their approach is. I don't know for sure. I'm personally kind of just sitting back and seeing what happens because for me, you know, I'm never going to stop fighting for awareness and obviously legislation as well. But one of the things that I really truly think is effective is people sharing their stories about these programs. Mm-hmm. I believe that my program shut down as a result of a journalist who came in and shed a huge light on my program and what was happening there. And she dug into the archives and she pulled out the abuse stories. She pulled out the communications and the lawsuits and she put it up there. She made it relevant again. And her name was Alexandra Zayas. She did a piece on Lighthouse, I think in 2013. And truly, I believe being able to search a program and find those stories, find that information immediately, like chop Google result is what makes their attendance go down and what ultimately will shut them down. Like if legislation's not going to do it, telling your truth will. And that's why I think the awareness aspect of advocacy is so, so important.
Love that. Yeah. There's so much of this where it's like a lot of these organizations aren't bothered by legislation anyway. It can do obviously big things like schools can be shut down or dispersed. It can be a lot harder for them to operate. Yeah. But at the end of the day, it's going to be parents who are looking up these programs, listening to stories. It's going to be family, friends that are listening that are going, oh, you're sending them there? Have you seen this? Like, that's such a huge piece of it. And
it's hard to sometimes convince parents who have troubled teens that that all residential treatment is bad, because for them, that's the end all be all. I've tried all the other options. I have nothing else to do. And, you know, I could go on night and day about my view on residential treatment and how I don't believe any forced residential long-term treatment is appropriate. I think they're all abusive. But for parents who are desperate, and that's why they're so easy to prey upon by these programs, you know, it's really hard to convince them that all the programs are bad. So just having your story, having your truth out there is what will make the difference. I think that most parents who send their kids to these programs are not just monsters of parents. They are looking for a solution. They are trying to help and protect their child. They're just preyed upon, taken advantage of, and misinformed. Yeah. So by informing them of these programs, putting our stories out there and making sure they're, you know, high on the results thing, parents find them and they'll say, okay, I won't send my kid there. And at least if even if they do go, oh, I'm going to send my kid to a different program, this one is the bad one, then at least they kind of see some signs of what to look out for, you know, when they read these articles, when they're looking through programs and they're seeing story after story of, oh, this happened, you know, then they start to know what to look out for. And we've talked about, I don't know if you and I talked about, but I've talked about red flags before and making parents aware of red flags. Which so often are at every single residential, you've probably never talked to a survivor of a TTI program that hasn't had their letters read, sharpied out, or made to rewrite them. Like that's a red flag that you will find at almost every single troubled teen program out there, that they go through your mail and they monitor your communications. So that in itself, I don't understand why any parent would ever be so dumb to send their child, but we can do a lot by just making sure that the information is readily available when parents do try to do some research.
Yeah, right. Like you said, there's a lot of well-intentioned people that, you know, even the religious side that they're like, oh, they need, you know, they're convinced that, like, oh, if they go to 20 services a week, that's going to have some impact. Or if they go here and get around these types of people, they'll be better. Yeah. And you hit that a lot in your first episode with me, like just saying you don't really blame your parents. Like, they were trying to put boundaries and protection for you and ended up kind of doing the opposite in a lot of ways. Before we get into what you're working on lately, I do want to talk about your experience at Hiles Anderson, because, which probably will sound like a cakewalk compared to what we've talked about before. But it is an important step for sure. And it's something we didn't talk about in our first conversation. So after leaving Lighthouse, how'd you end up at Hiles Anderson? Because your parents, for those that are listening, your parents were Berean, like they weren't IFB. Yeah. But it seems like you kind of got into the funnel of the IP world through Lighthouse.
Totally. Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
So at Lighthouse, one of the senior pastors, I guess I'll call him, had gone to Hiles Anderson. He would promote Hiles Anderson all day long to us. He was older. He was probably like mid-60s, I'm guessing. He was an older man, but he was there for like the revivals and like, you know, all that crazy stuff. And he would talk about it nonstop to us. And because this program was so extremist, by the time I was getting ready to leave, I was convinced that the world, right, was going to kill me. Like legit thought that I would go out in the world and my old friends would come find me and kill me. That's such an that's so beyond what reality was. But in my head, after being, you know, indoctrinated day in and day out for 4 years, I really believed that when I went outside of a very strict Christian environment, that I would do something to get killed. And this affected me really deeply, even so much like oftentimes you're not supposed to go to movie theaters. But when I went to my first movie theater when I got out of that program, I was very like disturbed at the sight of like people dying. I was like, oh my gosh, they're going in the movies, they're dying and they're going to hell. And I was like so just distraught about it because I had just been so indoctrinated. But anyway, he had been a huge Hiles advocate and he encouraged me to go to Hiles Anderson or to go to any Christian college, really. He's like, you got to get in a Christian college and you leave this place. If you don't, you know, bad things are going to happen. Your friends will find you. And like very, very verbatim, actually, that conversation happened. Even the pastor of the entire program for the last, like, I want to say 6 to 9 months that I was there was doing private training with me. I don't remember what it was called, but it was some kind of Christian training to prepare me to go back out in the world. I didn't go outside for like 6 months. I would just stay inside and he and I would do this study together that was supposed to help me when I got back out in the world. And so they were very like, you need to go to a Christian college. And I was like, okay. Well, there was another staff member at the program who had already resigned to going to Hiles Anderson. And I thought, well, maybe if I stay next to her, then I'll be safe and, you know, I'll be able to go back into the world and remain a good Christian. You know, I think I want to be a missionary. At the time, I wanted to be a missionary to Canada. I don't know why that was crazy. But I was like, I'll go back into the world. I'll see who I am. And I'll go alongside her and she'll keep me safe because she'll be like the element of this place that I'm taking with me. And so her and I both signed up for Hiles Anderson. I was in like the Jericho program.
Yeah.
And we had asked to room together. And I actually found out later that my program down in Florida called Hiles Anderson and told them to not allow her and I to room together because they thought that I would be a bad influence on her. We were like very friendly, this me and the staff member. And also I found out she was gay. She had told me like the last week secretly that she was gay. So there very likely could have been an inappropriate element to that relationship that I just didn't recognize most of our time together, but I digress. So I went to House Anderson with her, and it was a really jarring experience because, you know, House Anderson in itself is so incredibly strict, so incredibly sexist, so incredibly misogynistic.
Really?
And I think it's so I just hate it. And I really do. I really hate it because I really looked at it through the lens of coming from my program, or now I do at least. And I just think, you guys are like subjecting yourselves to this, and you never had to.
Yeah, right.
And that's like, that's
and paying
the weird
for
part.
It.
Yeah, they're
you're
paying
personally
for
paying for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I went to Hiles, and you know, I brought all my skirts with me, and it was a wild, weird experience, kind of progressing from my program to Hiles, because, like you say, it did feel a lot looser. It felt a lot more relaxed to me than my program. But at the same time, you know, as I was kind of exploring who I was outside of that program, I was finding things about myself that were still kicking against the rules of Hiles Anderson. I mean, I would get in trouble for like taking my one earring and putting it on a millimeter up my ear instead of the hole down here at the bottom. You know, I got in trouble for trying to move a desk once when I worked for the dean of women's office. I literally got scolded and told to go find men to move this desk because women shouldn't move desks. And then the school really seemed to target me, honestly. And I don't know if my program had communicated with them or something, because I really wasn't breaking any rules. I just didn't really want to be there. After like 6 months or so, the brainwashing was falling off of me. I was figuring out kind of who I was and what I was interested in and what I wanted my life to look like. And it wasn't these, you know, classes on winning souls to the Lord. You know, it wasn't that. I just wasn't about it. But I was also undergoing a lot of health problems at the time. A lot of like the trauma from my program was like coming out in me as I was kind of just, I don't know what the word is, deprogramming. I suddenly started having massive anxiety and massive panic attacks, and it was causing physical symptoms that ended up hospitalizing me like three times while I was there. And when I came back to the school from the hospital, the dean of women, who I can't remember her name at the moment, terrible woman. She told me I had just come back from the hospital. I was very sick in the hospital, had a spine tap, like really like a lot of stuff. And, she told me I was losing weight, which I wasn't. But she said I was too thin, and that I must be anorexic or bulimic or something. And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I've never been anorexic or bulimic in my life. I was very thin, but I always was very thin.
Yeah.
And I had roommates at the time who, bless them, I genuinely love them to this day. I'm still friends with them on Facebook. They're very much Baptist Christians, and I still love and support them. But they supported me, and they were like, no, like she eats pizza every single day from the cafe. They're like, she's not anorexic or bulimic every day. But they actually told me, the dean of women told me, if I lost a single pound, she would kick me out of the school. And she actually made me report to the medical office to be weighed on a weekly basis. And I thought, this is the most crazy. Can I cuss on here? This is the most crazy fucking shit that I've ever experienced in my life. Not even at my program did they weigh me on a weekly basis to ensure that I wasn't losing any weight. I thought, that's so overbearing. Yeah. And then there was times where she'd call me in and she'd ask to go through my cell phone. And I'd be like, no. But she just thought that she had the authority to go through my personal cell phone, not like the computers that the school provided for us, which maybe there's some argument to that, but when they did that, but like my personal cell phone, and I would be like, no. And yeah, I just had a lot of like run-ins with the dean of women there. They seemed very controlling and like they had something out for me. But that's just my personal experience with them as a whole. Hiles Anderson, the fact that they have, I always said the biggest red flag to Hiles Anderson with me was how many posters they have of preachers just all adorning all the walls. It's very telling who they worship there. You'll never guess.
I visited 2015, maybe 2016, and visit like 11 PM or something, but it was like, it was like we went in the main office, toured around, and it was like statue Jack Kyle's outside, huge poster of him inside the lobby, like so much merch in their gift shop of like Jack Kyle's and all this. It's like literally like Disney. I've described Jack Kyle's like the Walt Disney of like Baptists, you know, like there's so much love and appreciation of him everywhere you go. At the time you were there, I really want to know who the Dean of Women is, because I like to name the names.
Hair. I'll have to ask the girls that I was there with later, but I don't.
But she's still there?
No.
You know?
No, okay. She left not long after.
Close out the website. Snooping while you were saying
I'll find her. I'll find her. No, she's not still there, but she was crazy to me.
Yeah.
Crazy to me.
What time frame was this that you were there?
So I left in 2011. So this would have been late 2011.
To your pre-Scott scandal then, just
Scott
barely.
Scott was still there. Yeah, he was still there. So this was 2011, maybe a little bit of early 2012, but I was only there for like 6 months, I think.
Yeah.
Before I ultimately the Dean of Women pulled me in and she was like, I don't think you want to be here, because I was very sick and I was like literally almost passing out in my classes, like not falling asleep. Like I was not well.
Yeah.
And she's like, we don't think you want to be here. And I was like, okay. And she was like, so we think that maybe you want to leave. And I'm like, well, my parents have paid for this, so I'm going to do whatever my parents want me to do, because it's their money. And she was like, okay, well, you can go talk to your father about it and then come back to me. And I was like, okay, cool. And she's like, you have an hour. I'll call your next class. I'm like, oh, okay, so I have an hour to decide whether, like, she pretty much forced me out the door at that point. Right. It was clear that they didn't want me there. I felt very unwelcome. I don't know why. I don't know if my program talked to them and told them my business. It seems to be a very whispery little community.
Yeah, it could have been anything. It could have just been they picked you at random, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what it was, but they suspected that I was probably not one of them, and rightfully so.
And they were right, yeah. Yeah, I have to imagine too, like you're deprogramming from this program and it's a triggering environment because you're hearing all the same kind of messages and preaching and everything. Since that point, I mean, obviously you started sharing. So there's that gap between 2011 and 2020. Like, was that process kind of just like, I'm going to leave this behind and not talk about it? Or was there any kind of like trying to work through that and figure that out?
Initially, the first thing you said. So initially, when I got out of Hiles and I came back to California, because my parents were like, yeah, like, just come home. Like, let's just bring you home. I came home and I just didn't want to talk about anything. That's what it was. I assumed at this point that my parents were privy to how my program itself operated. My parents had already not really been interested in like the IFB movement, we wear pants in my family. They don't drink, but they're not like extremists in any sense of the word. So I didn't really have to defend that school or feel like I needed my parents' support to leave that place. Ironically, the few times that I did gravitate towards IFB institutions, even churches outside of my program, like my parents weren't really interested in it. That was more for me. I had been brainwashed to believe that if you were not this devoted to like being this extremist, that it just wasn't real Christianity. That's kind of what I thought. I thought, well, everyone else is like the joke and I'm taking this serious. You know, that's how I felt. They had discouraged so much, you know, the rock music in the church and the women who wear pants and the women preachers, da, da, da. But my parents weren't of that mindset. So I didn't really have to defend Hiles to them, but I did feel like they were on board with my program. Yeah. I'm not sure why I did think that, but I did. Probably because my parents signed contracts and I just assumed that they would have done extensive research on how this place operated. Mm-hmm. And I think they tried to, but I also know for a fact that in the paperwork they signed, they were lied to about the way that this program operated.
Yeah.
So when I got back, I was just like, I don't want to talk to anybody about this. I just want to keep continuing figuring out who I am as an adult woman, you know, whereas the last time I had this freedom, I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So I really had no idea who I was, what my hobbies were, what my interests were, what kind of character I had when I wasn't being loomed over by all of these incredibly oppressive forces. And I just didn't want to talk about it. So I didn't. I didn't talk about it for years. I think I began kind of opening up about it by making snide remarks to my parents. Like, hey, remember when you sent me away for 4 years and abandoned me? Like just dumb stuff mm-hmm. like that, where I kind of let them know that I wasn't too happy with their choice there, but never kind of opening up to them about what I actually experienced. The closest I got was like in talking with my friends, I would kind of say, oh, well, in my high school, you know, everyone's talking about their high school experiences because those are such formative years, right? So yeah. You get in conversations with people who are talking about, oh, I played on the sports team and it taught me like teamwork and camaraderie and all these things. And I'm like, oh, well, I spent a couple of days in an isolation box and learned nothing. And then people are like, you know, that's like majorly fucked up, right? And I would be like, yeah, I guess. Yeah, that is kind of fucked up, huh? I'm like, I disobeyed. And they're like, still kind of fucked up, though. And I'm like, yeah. And so I kind of started making these connections.
Start realizing, like, oh, yeah.
It's actually never appropriate to lock a child in an isolation room. Like, that's actually never appropriate. It's never been effective. It's never been proven treatment. And I didn't deserve it. And so those kind of instances continued to sort of open me up. And when I was really sure that, you know what, I was abused for like 4 years and brainwashed and indoctrinated and treated really terribly. And, you know, I have 12, I have a bunch of nieces and nephews. And I think if anyone ever treated them the way that I was treated, there would be violence. Like literally, I'm like, there would just be no way on earth that anybody would treat a member of my family the way that I was treated as a child. Mm-hmm. And so kind of when I really was solidifying, like, wow, this narrative is when I asked my mom one day. I was just at their house for dinner and we had kind of reestablished a decent working relationship. Mm-hmm. And I had said, you know, did you ever tell my program that I was anorexic or bulimic? And she said no. And then she asked me why. And I'm not going to cry because I cry every time I tell this story. But she asked me why. And that was the first time that my parents really showed interest in what happened there. And I told her, I'm like, well, you know, they made me throw up on my plate, like in front of everybody, because they said I was anorexic or bulimic. And they made me throw up in like a bucket and make me carry around the bucket, like in the building. Like I'd have to walk room to room with like a Home Depot bucket full of puke because they were force feeding me, overfeeding me, forcing me to eat within very limited times. And it was really difficult on me because I was very tiny, as I always had been. So that's because they thought I was bulimic or anorexic. And that's why I was asking my mother. And so that was the first story that I ever told her, first instance of abuse that I ever shared with her from my program. And she was immediately in tears, immediately mortified that they would do this to her daughter, as was my father. And, you know, today they kind of come from a standpoint of like, well, we had to do something, but they definitely know they made the wrong choice in choosing that program for sure.
Right. Right. Is your relationship with them pretty solid now at this point, would you say?
Yeah. Yeah. My relationship with them now is great. They live in Florida now. I go see them a couple times a year if I can. But yeah, we have a great relationship. They're very supportive in my advocacy work. You know, they've read the magazines, watched some videos, yeah. Seen some podcasts. They're willing to engage that content to a certain extent. It is hurtful for them to kind of hear about things that happen to me. So right. I can't say that they watch everything I do, but they do support me. And they've supported my latest effort as well. They've donated money to things that I've been doing yeah. for the survivors and all those things. So I always say that I'm very fortunate. You know, there are a lot of parents out there who gave up on their children. And that's the reason yeah. their children were put into a program. There's a lot of parents out there who were abusive themselves. And that's probably why their kid was acting out to begin with. And right. yeah. and have been, you know, terrible to survivors or their children. And so I am incredibly, incredibly lucky and fortunate and privileged to have parents who both understand what they did wrong and support me on my journey of bringing awareness to this issue. So
yeah, it's so rare. And like you said, there's so many parents who are just abusive themselves, but they get to call it punishment and then they get to call their kids violent. It's a kind of interesting dynamic. Yeah. So you mentioned missing out on your formative years. And as king of segues, I'm going to use that to talk about what you're working on now. So many people in cults and in trouble teen industry have missed out on a lot of those moments that are huge. Like you mentioned sports teams. Yeah. Some would say, you know, they even missed out on things like prom. So tell us, what are you working on to help kind of retroactively address that?
Great segue. So I am working on an event called Survivor Prom. And that is for survivors of the troubled teen industry. It is for survivors of cults, which I would consider Hiles one, just saying. And it's for survivors of other congregate care settings. So that might include residential treatment, residential centers, foster care like systems where children may have missed out on some of the same experiences by being homeschooled, et cetera. Survivor prom is prom for survivors of those things. It's prom for the adults. It's for people who missed out on not just prom, but a lot of those experiences, like you say. There are things that people I think probably think are a little petty, things like prom, things, but that also extends into things like, oh, well, I also missed my sweet 16. You know, my gift for my sweet 16 was I was allowed to talk to three people with a listener for 25 minutes. That was my gift for my sweet 16th birthday. You know, it's not like I needed that big TV show party, but like I got to talk to people. That's what I was allowed. I was allowed to open my mouth. That's what that was for me. So we missed our sweet 16s. We missed our graduations. You know, my high school graduation, again, I am blessed, and privileged to have gotten an accredited education. But a lot of people did not. When they came home to their home states and presented, you know, here's my education that I got from the program in Florida, their colleges said, absolutely not. This is not accredited. And they literally had to go get their GEDs after being abused for years. Like they're at a severe disadvantage. And even the graduation ceremonies itself, you know, people love that moment for themselves. You're celebrating an accomplishment. You're celebrating a transition from your adolescence into adulthood. It's a huge deal. And for my graduation, I had to get on stage and talk about what a wretch I was. And I'm so glad that my parents sent me here and changed my life. And I had to give them flowers. That was my graduation. So those are just a couple of events, but you also miss out, like I had said earlier, on the camaraderie of sports teams, of knowing how to be part of a team, how to work as part of a team. You miss out on forming friendships, you know, at the program and often in cults and other places. You know, you're not allowed to make friends. I was literally punished for making friends, like punished for making friends. And obviously there's no romantic relationships during those years. You're not learning how to kind of engage with the opposite sex and what's appropriate and how you deal with that. So people come out of these programs oftentimes and become adults, that are just severely lacking in a lot of their social skills. They don't know a lot about themselves a lot of the time. You know, children are put through conversion therapy in these programs. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, in my program, it was a sin to be gay, to be bi, to be anything, but you know, the body you were born with. So they don't even know those things about themselves because they've been denied and punished for them for so long.
Yeah.
So people sometimes discredit what high school does for you. But if you talk to a survivor of the troubled teen industry, we can tell you what it does for you because we're out here trying to rebuild after. Yeah. So prom is just kind of a symbol, right? It's like a symbol of taking back those years of our lives, taking back that time. And prom is something we obviously all missed out on. So it'll be a blast. Survivors are going to come together and kind of celebrate just us. You know, we've done a lot of advocacy work the last few years, this entire community. And there really is no fight against the troubled teen industry without this community because people don't care. They're full of excuses or they don't know. And so without the survivors, there is no fight. And I think it's really important to celebrate this community. I think it's really important to support this community and to kind of shine a light on them for once, you know, instead of the next generation who is also important and we're going to keep fighting for them. But we got to love the people we have now. And that's kind of what Survivor Prom is about.
Yeah, that's awesome. And when is it? And for people that are going, you know, hey, I'm not going, but I want to support what's going on. What's the best way to do that?
So the event itself is on October 21st. It is in LA. Excuse me. And it's going to be at a Hilton hotel. However, I'm not sharing which one just
interesting.
Yet.
A Hilton hotel. No.
I'm not sharing which one just yet, just because we did get discounted rooms. So if you're interested in attending Survivor Prom, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. We have a Facebook group, the Survivor Prom Committee. And you can find a lot of the information or the links available on those. And that's also where you will find the link eventually here to the discounted hotel rooms, as well as tickets for the event. And if you're interested in supporting prom or the survivors attending, you can click one of the fundraising links that we have available on our Linktree. And that will give you the option to donate. If you'd like to donate, the funds go towards things like audiovisual equipment, security, food and beverage, obviously the venue, the floor, the decor, lots of expenses going into prom. So if you want to help support us in that, just click the link at our Linktree.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I definitely encourage people to do that if you're listening to this episode. And be sure to head back and listen to Hannah's full story if you haven't already, because we just kind of skimmed the surface and gave a 10,000 foot view of so much of your early part of your story. But thank you so much again for coming on. And I'm looking forward to seeing all these updates of prom.
Thanks so much, Eric. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes. And don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.